most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Government and I'm here to help. And I'm here to help.
All right. Got an awesome, awesome show for you today. I'm so excited about this. He had an incredible 30-year career in the FBI, 23 of those years as the FBI hostage negotiator, and then retiring as the first ever chief of the FBI Crisis Negotiating Unit and the Critical Incident Response Group. Since retiring, he's published a book about his life called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, that covers his entire career and served as the inspiration for the TV miniseries Waco, Gary Nesner. Gary, how are you, bud?
I'm doing great. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. I'm so excited about this. Can you tell me first, I want to know, how did you get involved in the FBI? Is that something you always wanted to do?
Well, I mentioned it in the book. When I was a kid, I watched a kid's show in the afternoon, the Mickey Mouse Show, which was popular back in the 50s. And they had an episode where the host went to see J. Edgar Hoover in the FBI headquarters building. You know, and Hoover was talking about chasing gangsters and spies and arresting criminals, and went to the firearm range and shot the 45 machine gun. And, you know, I was sold. I said, well, that's what I want to do. And I actually got it wrong in the book. I said I was about 10 or 11 or 12 or something like that. But in reality, I spoke at a conference a couple of years ago, and they surprised me. They found an original tape of that show, and it turns out I was about 8 years old when I saw that show. So I, pretty early on in my life, kind of found something that sounded really exciting to me, and it eventually worked out.
Did you end up there while Hoover was there?
Actually, funny enough, but you know, when I joined the FBI literally months after he died. He died in, I think, the summer of 72, and I joined the FBI in the fall of 72. But he was still with us for quite a while, in spirit, I guess you would say. He obviously, anybody that ran an outfit for 48 years had a profound effect, and you know, in both positive and negative ways.
The negative stuff, how long do you think that took to get out of the FBI? Or is it still there?
I don't know. It's, you know, he certainly had probably an everlasting impact to some extent on the culture of the FBI. But as each year's passed since his death, I mean, his legacy becomes a little less prominent. I think, you know, like a lot of historical figures, you know, it's complex. You know, he did a lot of great things, and you have to give him credit for establishing for a long time, maybe today, is the finest law enforcement agency in the world. And then there was abuse of power. You know, you stay in power too long, and you know, there becomes all kinds of issues that come from that. So, it's just like if you study President Kennedy, you know, he was a favorite president of mine, but, you know, a flawed man in many ways, if you look at his private life. So, you know, I think we tend to want to put public figures, be they politicians or otherwise, up on a pedestal and make them heroes. And often when we peel back the layers of the onion, we find that, well, they're just flawed humans like the rest of us. And you have to have a balanced perspective on that, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Did you start in Florida?
Well, I actually started, I just gotten out of college, and I was actually too young to be an FBI. You had to be 23, and I was 21, but I still wanted to join the FBI. So I started as what they call a support employee. They used to call it a clerk back in those days. So I went up to Washington, D.C. and worked in a supportive role to what some agents were doing. I actually worked on a squad handling espionage. It was kind of interesting, and met my wife up there, and I got transferred back to my hometown in Florida. And from there, I got in the agent school, and then our first assignment was South Carolina. And then the bulk of my career was in the D.C. area, either working first in the Washington field office or the last dozen years as a negotiator at Quantico, so where we were signed physically. So, yeah, it was I was very rare in an FBI family. I raised my three kids, long since adults and parents of their own, solely in one house. That's literally unheard of from people of my generation in the FBI, where you typically would have had a series of moves along your career.
Wow. How did you manage to stay in the same place? I guess because you were probably traveling everywhere.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, when you, in the FBI, when they send you to a big office, a big city, you know, most people, because of the expense of a big city and the commute, they want to eventually transfer to their hometown or some smaller town, wherever you're from. But because my career ended up moving from investigating in the Washington field office, not headquarters, and then Quantico, it just, my career kept me in that area, and that provided an, you know, as a side benefit, an unusual degree of stability for my children. My wife and I bought the house we lived in for 30 years before the kids were born. So,
wow.
And the last one was in college when we sold it. So, yeah, it was an interesting, a great place to raise a family. We moved out of the area some years ago, so, you know, seeking a little bit quieter life, but yeah, it was good.
Wow. So you started out as an agent after that, right?
Yeah, essentially, yeah. For, you know, most of the jobs that people would recognize as being involved in investigations and dealing with crisis events, all the personnel involved in those positions are special agents. It's sort of a generic term, but there's obviously different pay grade, levels within that overall arching title.
So how do you get lined up being the hostage negotiator?
Well, with most of the FBI, agents tend to have a set of auxiliary activities. I mean, let's say an agent is assigned to, healthcare fraud or political corruption or organized crime. In addition to those daily duties, you would perhaps have a sidelight. You'd be an evidence response technician. You'd be a polygraph operator. You'd be a firearms instructor. And there's just a myriad of those kinds of specialties. And, hostage negotiation was a brand new emerging field that the FBI had sort of copied from New York City in the mid-70s. And when I heard about it, it had an instant appeal to me. So I became a negotiator, and it was a part-time function for me for many years until eventually, in 1990, they asked me to be one of the two or three full-time negotiators at Quantico because of the work I'd done in the field. You know, it just serendipitous, I guess.
Did you like doing it when you were part-time?
Yeah, I mean, I had a very interesting career. You know, it's outlined in my book. I was working terrorism cases out of Washington. So anytime there was a hijacking or a case against Americans overseas, I worked in literally a squad of about 8 or 9 guys that flew to every one of those things. We were the entirety of the FBI's response structure then. Now everybody in the FBI, to one extent or another, works terrorism. But back in those days, not so much. It was just a few of us. So, so I'm doing that all the time. And then when I'm back in the country, I'm teaching negotiation courses and I'm going to call outs with the police and, coaching swim meets and coaching soccer. And, it was a pretty intense and fun life. You know, I think overall I was a pretty good dad, but I certainly didn't lead a normal life that others.
Right. So do you remember the first one that you got involved in?
I don't really. When I first got my initial training as a negotiator, obviously I had no practical experience. And I was very fortunate to link up with Lieutenant George Badford of the Washington Metropolitan Emergency Response Team. And, I went to George and said, George, listen, I can't regale you with my personal stories of negotiation, I said, but I have a lot of information close to the instructors at the FBI Academy. Through them, I can get you videos and audios and case studies, and I can help give presentations to your training. And George was kind enough to more or less almost absorb me into their team, so I got to roll out on a lot of their callouts and gained some pretty good field experience in the process. And then I had my own opportunities to work cases that were more FBI centric, which, some of which I talk about in the book. So, all of these things kind of build up to your level of comfort in dealing with these kind of unique crises. And, negotiations is an interesting business. We all learn a lot from each other, and the do's and don'ts we probably learn as much from what not to do as what to do. So it was an interesting time, to say the least.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you have, because I imagine there's not one of them that turns out to be the same situation.
They're all unique. The reality is a fairly small percentage of them are truly hostage situations. We're known as hostage negotiators, but truth be told, it's only about 10% of what FBI and the cops do. And that's where somebody is holding someone and they have a specific demand. You want something you can't get, so you hold a hostage and threaten to kill them unless I give you what you want. Frankly, those are kind of easier because you're there to get your demand met. You're not there to kill somebody. You're trying to force me to give you something you can't get on your own. So we bargain with those people. And after a period of time, they come to realize they're not as powerful as they think they are because everything's taking a long time. We're not just simply jumping through the hoops because they say, I want this or I demand that. And essentially, they're left with two choices. You cooperate with the police or you run the risk of being hurt or killed. But 90%, we found out what law enforcement officers were responding to, negotiators, were actually emotionally driven situations. The guy threatening to kill his girlfriend because she's leaving him or the wife taking the kids, or the guy that's been fired by his boss at the factory, the the neighbors having an argument over a fence, the depressed girl on the overpass because she didn't get a date to the prom. I mean, you go on and on and on, the possibilities are endless, but those are tough because in those, they sound easy and run of the mill, but in reality, the only demand the person has is go away, leave me alone. I don't need you. I don't want you. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is really it's easy to exert some influence on somebody that needs you and needs you to do something for them. But if they merely want you to go away, then you really have to use some pretty significant crisis intervention skills and try to convince them that you're not there to make their day worse and you want to help them through whatever crisis or problem they have. And in fact, that's, I think, the big contribution that I helped spearhead in the business was attaching from the mental health community a set of active listening skills that we borrowed from the mental health community as tools for police negotiators to learn. So, you know, you open-ended questions, paraphrasing, labeling the emotions that you hear, really more of a crisis intervention model. You know, when a guy's climbed up on top of a bridge, he's going to commit suicide. You don't say, hey, you know, I'll trade you a hamburger if you don't kill yourself. It doesn't quite work right that way. So, you know, you kind of have to say, you know, what's going on? You know, what happened to you? And you're going to find that there's some personal trauma. They've lost a job. They've lost a relationship. And those are the things that need to be addressed. And, you know, people get tunnel vision. They feel as though the only way for them to deal with whatever problem they're having is to be self-destructive. And you know, you steer them away from that. You give them some sense of hope. And surprisingly, we're successful in the 90 percentiles, and there's very few things in law enforcement that are that successful, you know. Yeah. Because, Mike, there's what we call ambivalence. You know, part of that person out on the overpass or whatever, part of them wants to live and part of them wants to die, and that's the foot in the door that you have to try to literally pull them back and figuratively from the ledge. You know, the people who are dead set on killing themselves or someone else, they just do it, and you respond to a pretty horrific scene. But if we get that opportunity to engage, you know, we don't want to come across as the official, demanding, authoritative law enforcement officer. We want to be the empathic, understanding, hey, you know, man, it sounds like you've been dealt some really tough cards, and I want to help you get through this, you know, and I'm going to take you right now to get some mental health care and see if we can deal with some of these problems. You know, you're making a permanent decision for a temporary problem. Right. And if we're good at that, we save a lot of lives. And I think that's why law enforcement officers, you know, FBI or cops are attracted to it, because there's not a lot of things in life that give you that sort of, you know, you've got to be prepared for the failures, and they do occur, but there's nothing that gives you a greater sense of fulfillment or satisfaction than saying, hey, I kept this person from harming themselves. And, you know, the public may think we're dealing with all these incorrigible criminals and who cares about them, but in reality, most people aren't. They're just people going through a really difficult time, and, you know, you feel good about helping save their lives.
Oh, I can't imagine. There's probably nothing more fulfilling. So do you find that people mostly are looking for a way out, and that's your job to give them the way out of the situation? Like, they just wanted maybe a little attention for that moment, but they want a way out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly say that one way of saying it, but that might oversimplify it. I mean, right. there are those people we deal with who are just simply looking for attention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the likelihood that they will harm themselves is, you know, maybe not as high as you would think. But there are plenty of others that are, you know, deeply considering. I mean, even as a volunteer in the FBI, I worked on a suicide hotline for years just to help hone my skills. And, you know, and people would call in, and, you know, a fair number of them were just lonely people that wanted to talk to somebody late at night. But then now and again, you talk to somebody that this person's going to pull the trigger, you know, and you really got to step up your game and, you know, be there for them, if not physically, then certainly emotionally.
Do you have a game plan going into it, or do you come up with your game plan as you start talking to them?
The game plan, whether it's hostage or an emotional situation, is pretty much the same. You know, you want to have a relationship with somebody. You have to work on building a relationship of trust. So as a successful negotiator, you want to come across as sincere, genuine, honest, empathic. You try to slow things down and have a calm, soothing voice. And, you know, those things enable you to slowly build up a relationship. And then you begin to hear somebody say something like, Gary, I don't know how to get out of this. When I hear that, you know, that's an indicator to me that I've now established myself with this person to a level where they're open to my suggestions or my ideas or my alternatives that I present. So I mean, that's the goal. So the game plan, get back to your core question, is really build up that relationship. And you know, you have to do it in pretty challenging circumstances in a fairly short period of time. But it's amazing that when given an opportunity to talk about the issues that are important to them, if you ask the right questions and you ask follow-up questions on it, and you say, you know, well, gosh, Mike, you know, it sounds like that just hurt you to the core when your wife said that. You know, if I respond in that fashion and I get a bunch of those right, I'm not telling you, understand, I'm showing you, I'm demonstrating. I'm just saying, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I understand. Anybody can say that. But you say, like, you know, when this happened to you, this is how you felt about it. And when your boss told you he was letting you go, you felt as though he didn't appreciate any of the hard work you've done for this company. You know, these are just little quick snippets and examples of, if you respond effectively like that, not just in a negotiation, but in life, to be honest with you, it's the most powerful tool of social interaction that we have. And some people are very, very good at it. A lot of people are really, really bad at it. But, you know, that's kind of the approach. And it's tough because, you know, in law enforcement, I mean, you don't have to watch a whole lot of law enforcement shows to see that we have, you know, any number of people that come across as, you know, you better do this and you better do that. And we've got the command, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And that's really not what we're looking for. We're looking for that kind of, you know, we're not looking for an aggressive negotiator. We're looking for Columbo, you know, and remember that TV show? It's like, you know, yeah. Help me understand.
More cerebral.
Yeah. And good negotiators, you know, not exclusively, but they tend to be more mature cops that have been doing this for a long time. They're good at talking to people. They're in the FBI. They're good interviewers and interrogators, and they're good at developing informants and getting witnesses to share information with us. And, you know, those are kind of the same skill sets we apply to this. And, you know, it's not rocket science, you know. And then the most important thing, to be able to do this effectively, the number one thing I teach is self-control. You know, the premise being that if you can't control your own emotions, how can you expect to influence someone else's? You know, if you're the kind of person that gets all rattled and angry and frustrated, and you lose your cool, your chances of being successful are far less, you know. So even in some tense adversarial situations where, you know, where you're being insulted and you know, lousy cops, you're a bunch of jerks, you know, you don't care about me, all these kind of things come your way. If you deflect those the right way and don't overreact and maintain your cool, you're more likely to be successful.
I'm assuming that probably happens on the majority of calls where they're insulting you. Does that take time to overcome that? Was that hard to deal with?
Yeah. The insulting part is not uncommon, but it's right. Not every case. But in essence, people are suspect of law enforcement, regardless of the circumstances, showing up at the scene because, you know, I don't think there's too many perpetrators look out the window and say, oh, goody, the cops are here, you know, right. You know, because whatever I've done now, it's going to get worse because there's six police cars out here and the lights are on and the sirens are on. And I see guys running around with dogs and shotguns. And oh, boy, this is a mess now,
yeah,
you know,
it's scary. Yeah.
One of the first things we try to do is, once we've made the scene safe so that no innocent people are going to additionally get wrapped up in whatever's going on, we try to de-escalate. You know, we try to lower the pressure and the tension and really mean it when we say we're here to try to help you. You know, we're not interested in coming in and doing anything crazy and foolish. And so we have to be patient. We have to be creative. And, you know, these things generally work and they're accepted principles throughout law enforcement, although we still encounter the occasional law enforcement leader that, you know, wants to play the tough guy card because that's what they're used to doing. And negotiators constantly have to sort of counterbalance that.
Right. Yeah. I imagine that's a delicate dance you got to take. Can we talk about a couple of the cases? You were involved in one of the prison riot standoffs.
Quite a few of them, actually. But yeah, there's a couple I talk about in the book. Random House, when I wrote my book, they said, we want 85,000 words, which is about what my book is. But I gave them 185,000 words.
Whoa.
And, you know, and they came back to me and they said, well, hey, you know, how many prison riots you want to talk about? How many? I said, I don't know. I was just putting in everything I can think of in there. I said, well, you know, we just need examples of some of the big stuff. We don't need everything. So there's quite a bit more that never made it to the book. But which prison, maybe the Lucasville prison, is that the one you're referring to, or Talladega?
Yeah, the Lucasville one.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It happened the very last days of Waco. And I had already left Waco. I'd been relieved earlier, about halfway through it, and gone overseas to do something else. And came back, and my boss said, you're either going to go back to Waco, resume control, leadership of the team there, or you're going to go to Ohio for a prison riot. You know, that was my life back in those days. Jeez. And, you know, so the next day he calls me up, says, well, go into FBI headquarters. They're going to put tear gas in. So I drove to FBI headquarters from my home in Northern Virginia. And of course saw the gas go in, the consequences of that. It was pretty horrific and terrible thing, obviously. Mm-hmm. I was very angry at a lot of people for a lot of things that had, I think, happened there that probably could have been avoided. And I just walked out and got on a plane the next day and flew to this prison riot. What happened is it's the southern part of Ohio. And there was a program in the prison system to inoculate prisoners for tuberculosis. And I think there was a group of Muslim prisoners that objected to that on religious grounds. And they ended up taking some hostages amongst the correctional officers. And then there were two other groups that joined in, but separately. That one was a black criminal gang and one was a group of white skinheads. You know, and each group had a couple hostages and it was a mess. They were tearing the prison apart. They were threatening to kill people. The negotiators get on the phone talking to 10, 12 different inmates. And
were they all working together?
No, that's the problem. They weren't. You know, they had separate agendas. And not only did each group have a separate sort of agenda, but everybody on the phone, you know, one guy wants to talk to his girlfriend. Another guy wants this. Another guy wants that. Some guys wanted to bitch about a certain, set of circumstances in the prison, and that was of no consequence to somebody else, you know. So it was very disorganized and frustrating. So I think that when I got there, I think the thing that I helped them do is say, you know, we got to help these guys get organized, because, you know, surprisingly, you know, democratic organization is not a high level skill set in our prison population. So, you know, what we had to basically do is tell each group, you need to appoint a spokesman for your group. You need to decide what are the important issues for you that you want to discuss. And then we'll sit down with you and we'll give you an opportunity to share those with us. And we did. We set up a table on one side of the fence where three of them sat representing each of the groups. And there was a table on the other side where the authorities sat. And, you know, their primary goal was what I told them. I said, don't try to end this thing now. Just listen to these people. They want to be heard. When you engage in this kind of activity, you're basically saying, listen to me. I have things I want to say that are bothering me, whether those are legitimate or not. So that's what they did. They got organized, and eventually they came up with a list of demands that really weren't particularly difficult to address. And initially the authorities said, well, we're not going to do anything like that. You know, we gave into these demands and they're going to do this more. And I said, listen, look at the demands. There's stuff like, you will endeavor to put better food in the canteen. You will try to upgrade the equipment in the gym. You will consider giving us more time in the rec yard. Everything was qualified. You will try, you will look at, you will attempt, you know, you will do this and do that. And I said, if you really look through this list, I said, you really don't have to do any of these things, but you do have to, I suggest you try to address them in a very professional and appropriate way. But they're almost telling you, just say you look at this stuff so we can, after 8 days, get this damn thing over with, because they're tired of not getting food and not watching Oprah or working out or calling their girlfriend for, you know, sexting, whatever it is, you know. Right. And, you know, prisoners are creatures of habit, you know, they get in a routine too. So the authorities eventually said, okay, I think we can do this. And it surrendered. No one else was hurt. There was a correctional officer killed earlier in the incident, but unrelated to the negotiations. It was just a vendetta between one of the inmates and him. But it could have ended so tragically and with significant loss of life. And yet, you know, with some thoughtful analysis, with some slowing it down and being creative, you know, they found a way to create an opportunity where these guys were comfortable, you know, putting their homemade weapons down and coming out peacefully.
So how does it end? So once you hear their demands and you guys try to give them the demands, how does that one particularly end?
Well, one of the things we did is many of them had worked with this well-known defense attorney in Ohio who had handled some of their cases, and they wanted him brought into the negotiations. And so he did. He came and met with them. And they basically asked him, they said, you know, this list of things that we have asked for, are you able to guarantee that the authorities will do it? And he was very honest and appropriate. He said, I can't guarantee any of this. He said, but I'll tell you, I have talked to the warden. I'm convinced that they are serious about looking into every one of these things. And they said, that's all we need to hear. And that sealed the deal. So, you know, he was an intermediary, not so much, we don't use intermediaries as kind of neutral arbiters bringing two opposing parties together. We use them as sort of guarantors to what we're doing to convince somebody that you know, we're acting in good faith and we'll do what we say we're going to do. And it makes him feel more comfortable. I've used that kind of intermediary many times.
Right. What's the craziest thing that has been asked of you during a negotiation?
Well, I'll give you a good, not me per se, but we did have a case back in the, oh my goodness, it must have been in the very late 70s, early 80s in California. They call him the famous Birdseed Bandit. And the guy robbed a bunch of banks. And they finally caught him in a bank. And obviously someone with mental health, significant mental health issues. And his demand was that they bring birdseed for every bird in California and disperse this birdseed. And, you know, they eventually got him to surrender. But it's, you know, it was a pretty bizarre demand. There was another one in a suburb of Cleveland where it was a black man who actually took hostages in a police station. And his demand was pretty simple. He wanted all the white people in the face of the earth to leave the face of the earth within 24 hours. And then later he wanted to talk to President Carter. And, you know, so you get some of this pretty bizarre stuff. But those are few and far between.
Right. Birdseed. That one, that's interesting.
Yeah, the Birdseed Bandit. Yep.
The Birdseed Bandit. I'm going to have to look that up after. That's pretty hilarious. Did you guys end up feeding all the birds?
Yeah, I'm sure we did. I'm sure we followed through. But, you know, I wasn't involved in that operation, so I just have to assume, we got, you know, got that taken care of.
Right. Well, good. Good. Okay, before Waco, we were talking about that, and I want to talk about that in a second. But before that one, the Ruby Ridge incident.
You know, my book was one of two books used for the six-part
Waco.
Paramount Waco series. And in that, they covered Ruby Ridge to an extent, because I mentioned it in my book. And even though I was not at Ruby Ridge, but obviously I know a lot about it. My partner was there. And I view it as, to some extent, a precursor to Waco with regards to the way the FBI managed the situation and some of the mistakes that were made there that carried on into the management of the Waco incident. So they did film that. And of course, the great actor Michael Shannon played me in the TV show. And
not bad.
They came to me and they said, listen, we have to put you in Ruby Ridge. And I said, what? I wasn't there.
Right.
I don't want to be seen as having been there. But they said, no, he's our big star and we need to get him in the first episode. And the only way we can do that is to have you at Ruby Ridge portrayed as doing what in reality your partner did, and actually a whole team of negotiators. So, you know, there wasn't much I could do about it. And Mike did he's just a great actor and a terrific human being. And it was a lot of fun.
So good. Yeah. So can we talk about, because you're probably very familiar with it, can you talk about some of the mistakes that happened at Ruby Ridge, kind of the prelude to Waco, and then we'll talk about Waco in a sec.
Yeah, I mean, like Waco, Ruby Ridge was another instance started by another agency. The Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had decided to try to recruit Randy Weaver as an informant. Because he had, you know, reportedly contacts with a lot of people in these extreme right-wing militias.
Was he himself in one of the militias?
I think that's debatable. I think he, you know, from what I understand, he had some fringe contacts. Anyway, they ended up getting an undercover agent or informant to buy a sawed-off shotgun from him. And in that process, you know, they charged him with illegally altering a federal farm. So that was the premise they were going to use to try to apply pressure to him to turn him into an informant against the others. But Weaver refused to show up and hid up in the mountain where he and his family had squatted for quite some years. And so the marshals were brought in to effect arrest warrant, and they began to make some surveillances of this mountain. And on one occasion in doing so, a team of marshals, spooked one of the Weaver's dogs, and Randy Weaver and his son, Sammy, I think a young teenager, and Kevin Harris, his guy that lived with him, they came out and they got into a confrontation with the marshals. And, you know, the son was killed, and Weaver and Harris, you know, escaped back up into the cabin. A marshal is killed, U.S. Marshal. It's just a terrible situation. So that begins the siege. And now the FBI comes out. And again, I'm out of the country at the time, but my partner was there. And I think the mistake that the FBI made was looking at this as though it was a running gun battle. And so setting up a tactical response seemed to take priority over opening up a dialogue to try to resolve this. Would have been challenging in any circumstance because you already have a young son that's been killed and a marshal killed. But ultimately, FBI marksmen were sent up to the near the house. And at one point, Weaver and Harris and one of Weaver's daughters came out of the house. And, a marksman from the FBI took a shot, feeling threatened for, reasons that I'm not going to defend. But Weaver's wounded. And as he goes back into the house, the second bullet rips through the front door and Mrs. Weaver's standing behind the door with a baby and she's killed. Mm. And it's, just making a terrible situation worse. So that's what we're faced with. But then and only after then do they finally roll up my partner and the other negotiators involved. And believe it or not, after 8 days, they use an intermediary, a guy named Bo Greitz, and they eventually get the Weavers to surrender without further bloodshed. So it's really, in some respects, a negotiation success, but a very horrendous situation and one that's, not surprisingly, received a lot of criticism for the way it was handled. Well, fast forward 6 months, then we have Waco. And some of the same decision-making problems that we had at Ruby Ridge were manifested again at Waco. But again, ATF starts out with an operation to arrest Koresh and execute a search warrant of the premises for illegally modified weapons. And the Davidians find out they're coming. There's a horrendous shootout and, four ATF agents are killed, 17 wounded. The largest gun battle on U.S. soil since the Civil War. Thousands and thousands of rounds of ammunition. Both sides had, semi-automatic weapons. And so the Davidians, several were killed, four or five. I don't remember the number. So ceasefire is obtained. And now we come in. That's when I get out there with and eventually my larger team to try to they bring about a peaceful outcome. And, it's tough when you start off in a hole, so to speak. It's not like, hey, nothing much has happened. Let's work together. Well, nothing much has happened is there's 17 wounded, four dead on one side and four or five dead and how many wounded on the other side, including Koresh himself. So it's kind of difficult to minimize what has transpired. And obviously emotions are high and anger and so forth. But, I had a really great team of negotiators and very proud of them. Waco's both the thing I'm the most proud of in the FBI and the thing I'm most troubled by, because we got 35 people out, including 21 children. And that's no small accomplishment considering the challenges we faced. But at the end of the day, there were those in the FBI that wanted to apply ever increasing amounts of pressure to sort of compel them to come out. And that, I don't think they appreciated the inconsistency that message sent to what we were doing as negotiators, despite our pleas to get them not to do that. So we were sending mixed signals, hey, talk to the nice man on the phone. And if you don't, the tank's going to crush your car. So that's not really the way it's done. It's against sort of the long held FBI approach, but that's how they did it out there. And eventually some of the aggressive activities on the perimeter shut off negotiations and no one else came out. That happened about 2 days before I was taken off of that position, and they brought someone else in that I think they felt would be more supportive of more aggressive action. And that is the case, but no one else came out. So that was it. And then eventually, armed with other alternatives, the FBI put in tear gas, and we know what happened there. The Davidians decided, the end is here, and they started the fires, and Koresh basically had everyone commit mass suicide. And the Davidians, some will argue against that, but the proof is pretty compelling that they started the fire. Now, clearly they did as a reaction to the FBI inserting gas, but nonetheless, you need to be correct about that. And Mike, what's really disturbing about the Waco situation is people tend to simplistically look at it as black and white. You're either big, bad, jackbooted government, and you came in there and you decided you want to kill all these people just for exercising their religious freedom. Or you take the view that they're a bunch of kooks and nuts, a bunch of idiots who let Koresh have sex with their underage daughters and believed in his nonsense, and they got what they deserve. Well, either one of these two perspectives, I think, is just it's intellectually lazy. It's far more complicated than that. Koresh was a manipulative person. I think you can certainly criticize his behaviors and his total control over his followers, but the people in there, for the most part, were decent people who were following what they thought was, the path to the religious enlightenment they sought. And on the outside, there was a lot of good people in the FBI working very hard. Even some of the decisions that I disagreed with, you know, the ultimate intent was for people to come out safely. It wasn't to set up a scenario whereby it ends the way it did. But life is complicated, and people tend not to want to delve in a complicated process of analyzing what happened. But it was complicated. There were good decisions and bad decisions on both sides. And, you know, I hope we learned a lot from that in the FBI. We made a lot of changes afterwards. I was given a promotion afterwards in recognition that we as negotiators had identified and pursued the right approach. 3 years later, we had an even longer siege in Montana with the Freeman, an anti-government group. And in this case, the director of the FBI said, "Hey, Gary, tell us what we need to do here." And he was extremely supportive, Louis Free, and we did. And it took 85 days, but nobody died. Nobody got killed. They surrendered peacefully. And, you know, no headlines, no lawsuits, no reputational damage, no organizational failure. You know, it showed again, you know, what I grew up liking as a kid, that the FBI, you know, despite some flaws here and there, was essentially a force of good and was trained and prepared to do good things. And we showed it there. But unfortunately, Waco is the one thing that sort of resonates and everybody remembers. And of course, it was the justification for Timothy McVeigh when he blew up the Murrah building in Oklahoma City 2 years to the date after the Waco fire.
Oh, wow. That's right. So going back to Waco, did you speak to David Koresh every day?
I personally spoke to Koresh the first night because I was basically the first FBI negotiator brought in. And by the time I got there at the end of the first day, those who had been speaking to him already were pretty much flat on their backs and exhausted. So I ended up speaking to him for about 12 hours. But once my team, I mean, I was already at a level at that point in time where my job is no longer to be on the phone, but to lead the team, develop the strategy and tell the bosses what we're doing and get their buy-in. So, but I did get a chance to talk to him. And I was somewhat hopeful that he was someone we could work with. But he was a very manipulative. One of my beefs with the Paramount TV program, the 6-part series that I wasn't involved in, my book was used as a basis for. One of my beefs is I think they unwittingly painted Koresh too sympathetically.
Yes.
A lot of people have come to that conclusion. You know, the director has told me that they were trying to show the charismatic personality attributes of Koresh that enabled him to attract his followers. I get that, fine. But people can be left with the wrong impression that he was a nicer guy. And it didn't help. You had Taylor Kitsch from Friday Night Lights playing Koresh.
I know.
And he did a brilliant job. But Taylor may be one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. He's just such a great, for me, young man. And he really should have gotten an Emmy Award for his portrayal of Koresh. It was just, I mean, I was on the set, the first day I was on the set, and I hadn't met Taylor yet. And I'm sitting in one of those director's chairs waiting for some scene to watch. And he goes walking by in costume, and I just about fell out of my chair. I said, oh my God, they've resurrected this guy, you know? And he was quite brilliant. So the whole cast were, I got to spend a lot of time with them. They really were terrific. And, you know, other than a few criticisms I have, I think the viewer of that show, it's on Hulu now. I just happened to see it on TV last night. It was on the Paramount Network, and then it was on Netflix for quite a while and got a lot of, it was in their top 10 for a couple of weeks. And then now it's on Hulu. You know, it's a really good production. I'm good friends with the Dowdle brothers who produced, directed it. But, you know, it has a few flaws. It's a complex story. And I suspect anybody involved would have some things they liked about it, some things probably they didn't. It certainly captured the emotion of the situation.
Yeah, it was intense watching it. Is that what's your main criticism? Is it that they made Koresh too sympathetic?
I think that's probably the top one. But also, and neither one of these directly relate to things I was involved in, but they tend to leave the viewer with the impression that ATF fired first on the initial raid. And I'm not sure that that's accurate. I wasn't there. I mean, I can't testify to it one way or another, but I think one of the TV camera people who were there covering the incident testified that the Davidians fired first. Yet there's a lot of people that say ATF did. I don't know the truth, but I think I would have left it a little vaguer than they did. They pretty much clearly laid it out that it was ATF. And then on the back end, the fire, I think they left it a little dubious as to how the fire started and that perhaps the FBI, knocked over lamps and started the fire, you know, and the arson investigation just doesn't support that. In fact, there's testimony from one of the surviving Davidians that I saw my fellow Davidians start the fire. Well, that's good enough for me, you know, so,
right.
And that didn't come out and should have been reported. But, you know, again, I'm not slamming them. They also used a book from David Thibodeau, one of the survivors, as kind of a look at the inside looking out. My book was The Outside Looking In. And I thought that was a unique and interesting way to look at the incident from both perspectives. But, you know, I think there are some conclusions that Thibodeau made that they incorporated in the film that, you know, as much as I got to know David and I like him, but I didn't agree with.
Mm. So how often do you talk to Thibodeau?
Oh, he called me a couple months ago on something, and I've never met him till we were on the set together. Yeah, and we had lunch one day during the filming, and, you know, they have a canteen they set up for people on the film set. And I think the whole set stopped to see whether these two guys would have a fist fight or whatever. But we got along very well. He's a thoughtful, intelligent guy, and, you know, you can question whatever choices he made earlier in life about, you know, whatever loyalties he did or didn't have to Koresh. He was never, I think, an official Davidian, but I like David. I liked him to this day. And I think he's a thoughtful, intelligent guy. I think he wasn't part of the Koresh team negotiating with us. So I think my personal view is he's made some assumptions about things we were doing that are his impressions, but aren't necessarily factual.
Have you two talked about the incident at all together?
A little bit. You know, we had a couple occasions to break bread together and talk about this. I think on might've been my second trip out to the filming in Santa Fe. He said, my mother's coming out. She has a bone to pick with you.
Uh-oh.
and I said, oh, okay. All right, I'll be happy to talk to your mom.
Right.
And sure enough, his mom is a very nice lady, but very outspoken. And she came out and she had a lot on her mind. She said, why didn't you let me talk to my son when I was out there? I could have convinced him to come out. And I said, well, first of all, at my level, I had no idea you were there. I'm not briefed on everybody who's on the perimeter. I said, but if I'd known, I wouldn't have done it. And it kind of set her back. She said, why? And I said, well, I don't know what kind of relationship you had. Maybe you could have got on the phone and convinced him to come out. But I'll tell you what, I can cite for you a dozen or more cases where they've put a family member on, and all it does is give the person inside the opportunity to say goodbye, to give their last will and testament. We don't do that. And Thibodeau, you know, even criticized us. Why didn't you let us talk to the press? No, you only have one voice to talk to. You're talking to the FBI negotiation team. That's it. You know, and we're going to be the single source. You're not shopping for who you like to talk to best. We're not going to let some family member get you all riled up or say, hey, give my baseball collection to, you know, my nephew or whatever it is. We don't want that. We might record a message, and we did some of that, a positive reinforcing, come out, I'm waiting for you, I love you, and play that. But we don't allow a scenario where there's can be a dialogue that we can't control and might be problematic. And I don't think she agreed with my reasons for that, but I think she accepted it, that we didn't discount her role just, you know, because we could. We had a rationale behind it.
Right. Because it doesn't make sense when you think about it. You're like, why just let him talk to him? But the way hearing you explain it, that makes perfect sense. Don't let him tie it up.
Yeah, during the Montana situation, we had the brothers of one of the guys inside wrote a letter. Could we ask them to write a letter? Would you write a letter to your brother, encourage him to come out and bring out your nephews who were in there with him? And this guy wrote a letter. We read the letter. We said, that letter ain't going in. He said, you miserable SOB. You know, you've ruined your whole life. You're an idiot. You're a stupid fool. Don't take your sons with you. You know, we said, okay, well, that's not really what we're looking for here. So we got a good laugh about it, but there's no way we were going to send that letter in. So, you know, that's why we filter that. If we had just put him on the phone, said, oh, well, that's his brother. Let him talk to him. You know, you assume there's this love there and affection. And boy, that can be a dangerous assumption to make because, you know, all families are in essence, to one extent or another, dysfunctional. So, you know, we don't know all of that history. So you have to be quite careful with that stuff. You know, during the early days of Waco, before the phone lines were captured by the FBI, there's an FBI negotiator talking to David Koresh, and an operator breaks in and says, I have a collect call or I have a phone call for David Koresh from A Current Affair, the TV show. And
really?
And the operator says, will you take the call? And the FBI agent says, operator, this is an FBI agent. This is this is an emergency situation. Do not break in this call. Operator just cuts off the FBI and puts on A Current Affair. Do we want David Koresh talking to trained FBI negotiators or to some idiot or bimbo reporter on a TV show that has no idea what's going on and may say something very stupid and unfortunate? You know, and that's the kind of thing we try to avoid. That's why we capture the phone lines so that they can only speak to us. You know, it's, you know, We don't do this, despite what people think, there's good cop, bad cop. There's just one voice you talk to. It's us.
How hard is that when the press is involved, because I think it's important that they document it. But say, like in the show, they portrayed the Davidians seeing the newspaper and then that tipped them off to knowing that you guys were there, like that kind of thing, like them being tipped off, you know?
You know, a lot of law enforcement colleagues think the FBI, the news media, rather, is nothing but a problem and an impediment. Yeah. And that's an exaggeration. There are times where the news media's coverage is helpful to us. For example, you know, when we were trying to convince Koresh to come out, you know, we said, David, you've been wanting to preach to the world. You know, if you come out and you have a trial based on what happened, you're going to have the largest audience that the world has ever seen.
Right.
And in fact, we know this had some appeal to him because during that incident, the major news magazines had his picture on the cover. Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, they all had his picture on the front. He wanted that. We sent him in so he could see. I mean, his ego, you know, so we're trying to tell him, look at the interest this is generating. You have a unique opportunity here to share your message with the world. That was okay with us. We're not trying to filter his message. He could preach till the cows come home for all I care. I just want to get people and children out alive, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes the news media can be a reward and, in essence, that someone get the coverage for something that they think is very important to them. Sometimes we'll say that, listen, this issue that's important to you that caused you to hold the mayor hostage or whatever, you've already succeeded. This is in the headlines now. The whole community is aware of this injustice that you feel has been done to you. There's no sense in killing the mayor or doing anything drastic. You've won. And sometimes people don't look at it that way. And you know, we can help them expand their thinking on that. And, you know, sometimes to our benefit. Negotiators, we're not trying to change the world. We're doing triage. We're trying to get people through a critical crisis. And, you know, we don't meet with them for therapy sessions after they surrendered. You know, we're just trying to get them to cooperate and to comply and to cease any further violence. That's when we go home and we've done that and we're happy with that.
That's interesting. That's a really good way of putting it. Have you ever talked to any of them after the situation?
Well, yes, a lot of people I've dealt with, I have talked to. In Waco, not so much, just Thibodeau. And I met two others at a 20-year conference in Baylor University in Waco. And those are the only three Davidians I've ever spoken with. But there are opportunities where we have talked to others who we've dealt with. And, you know, some are very appreciative of the work we did. Others, you know, have had a chance to think about things and maybe regret things that happened. I mean, it's hard to say. But, you know, it's interesting. The reason we did that is we would always ask, what was it that we said that made you come out peacefully? Because we're trying to learn, you know, let's take this to the bank and replicate it in the future. But the answer we got was always the same. And you'll find this interesting, I think. They always said, I don't remember what you said, but I like the way you said it.
Oh,
now,
wow.
You think about that. It speaks volumes to what we do as negotiators. We focus more on creating a relationship than we do solving a problem. People may not even always articulate what it is they hope to gain. And I told you, a lot of these people are motivated by a sense of loss of job, loss of relationship, loss of self-esteem, whatever it is. So by being this empathic ear, understanding what they're going through and how they feel about it, and why, and so forth and so on, it enables us to be of influence. And it's really quite effective.
Wow.
As my wife will say, it works everywhere but home.
Well, nothing works with the wives, does it?
No. Not in my house anyway.
Not in mine either. Let me ask you one more thing. So in the show, there was the power struggle. Why were you ultimately asked to leave the Waco situation?
Yeah. Again, some of the artificialities of it. You know, one of the things, I just make another quick comment, is
sure.
They typically showed Mike Shannon operating alone with one assistant. You know, in reality, we had 8 to 10 negotiators per 12-hour shift. Right. I mean, it's quite a complex, but obviously Hollywood's not interested in hiring 8 actors to sit in a room and, you know, provide background color, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things they attribute to me in the negotiations were, you know, composites of what negotiators generally did as a team.
Yeah.
What happened is we rotate personnel through on a 3-week basis. It's just something we've learned through the years that, and particularly speaking of the negotiation team, after about 3 weeks, you know, you kind of lose your creative edge and you're kind of burned out. So we begin to stagger people in and out so we get fresh ears, fresh eyes. And I had been there 4 weeks. You know, you don't necessarily have to rotate out the boss, but it was clear there were elements in the FBI, particularly on the tactical side, that felt I was an impediment to their desires to ratchet up the tactical pressure to force these people out. So, you know, I think someone at headquarters was sympathetic to that approach, and they said it's time to rotate out Nesner. And because we normally rotated people 3 weeks, I really wasn't in a position to oppose it. And, you know, obviously the TV show makes my departure look far more dramatic than it was in real life. But I mean, there was some tension there. But again, even when I left, I was told I'd be coming back again. But yeah, there was a lot of tension. You know, people say, well, the FBI wasn't communicating well. We didn't know how to talk to these people. And I think that's just not correct. We knew what we were dealing with. The negotiators certainly did. And we knew the best approach. And the success we had, I think, bears that out. But there was an opposing element in the FBI that just had a philosophical difference. They felt we as negotiators were mollycoddling these people. They were manipulating us. We were being duped, and they were never going to come out. And we had to just tighten the proverbial noose around them and force them out. You know, as a negotiator, I know that's what we call the paradox of power. The harder you push, the more likely you get resistance. But that wasn't appreciated. And we ended up doing both things, which screwed up the negotiation process, or certainly impeded us from being as successful as we would have otherwise been. So, I mean, that was a key lesson learned out of this. And, you know, both the on-scene commander and the tactical commander, you know, their careers were essentially over after Waco for, you know, some of the approaches they took. I, on the other hand, got a promotion. So there was a realization in the FBI that the negotiation program was, had read the situation properly and was embarked on what was the right strategy. You know, like I said, we did 85 days, 30 days longer in Montana, but the cost was significantly less, no lawsuits, no reputational damage. You know, the FBI is a proud organization and has a heralded history. But, you know, something like Waco causes the public to doubt the FBI. And we need the public. We need to be seen as competent and professional and unbiased and serving the public. And we are public servants. So when something like Waco happens, it's a serious blow to the agency. And, you know, it's sad when you know it could have been avoided and that we knew better than transpired out there. So hopefully it's back on the right track and we'll stay that way. It certainly got back on the right track long before I retired. And I was proud of helping make that shift back to what we'd been doing before. But, you know, it's all based on personnel. So who knows?
Do you ever wonder if you were left there, if you had more time, do you think it would have went differently, or do you think the result would have ultimately been the same?
I think at the time I left, if they had simply just given me more time, it would have taken a very, very long time to get back on track. Because what happened is, to make a long story short, near the last week I was there, we got seven adults out on one day. We were really making good progress. And rather than, you know, have decision makers support that and praise that, they went forward with tanks and crushed a bunch of cars. And basically, you know, everything that Pavlov told you not to do. And I told the boss, I said, you know, we've just taught our dog to fetch us the paper. And we worked at it for weeks. And now you kick the dog between the legs when he brings you the paper.
That was a great line.
You know, and it's true. And I said to him that, I said, the dog's not going to bring us the paper anymore, because the dog has figured out this ain't working out so well for me. You know, you may want the paper, but I'm not going through this butt kicking every time. And that's so basic psychology that I don't even know how to explain how that wasn't understood.
Right.
But, you know, decision makers didn't see the inconsistency of playing both cards, the sweet card and the hard card, and we paid a price for it. And it's tragic. You know, it's also tough on FBI agents. No one wants to think that their actions, their behavior brought about loss of life. But in essence, you know, I blame Koresh. Koresh every single day had the opportunity and was encouraged to come out and do the right thing, and many times turned that down. So he's ultimately to blame. But sure, that then does not mean we did everything right. So, you know, again, as I've mentioned several times, these are complex situations, and serious people who are serious about trying to find out need to take into all these different perspectives and really learn what happened out there, because it's not a simplistic thing.
Do you think that the TV show, I hate to keep harping on it, but do you think it ultimately has hurt what actually happened?
I don't know. I mean, I certainly have colleagues that were very disappointed in the TV show and expressed that to me. And, you know, but these are guys that kind of wake up in the morning and yawn red, white, and blue. You know, they put the FBI up in a pedestal, and they're never happy when the FBI is depicted in a flawed manner. But, you know, some of those same people weren't necessarily there and didn't see these problems or issues. I'm a big believer in, we change in law enforcement not because we have a good idea. We change because we are criticized. We are sued in court. We are publicly shown to have not acted as well as we might have. Those are the motivations that cause us to change. So, you know, there's a whole generation of FBI leaders now that don't even know what happened happened at Waco. So when they see a TV show like this, I hope at a minimum, you know, should they have to manage a situation like that in the future, they realize, okay, here's some of the things we need to avoid. You know, it's not a given that because you're a top leader in the FBI, you know how to manage a major siege. I mean, it's like a guy's a two-star general in the Army. He's in charge of finance and budget. And you say, okay, well, lead Desert Storm. Well, it's a whole different skill set. You know, right. he may have the stars on his shoulder, but this is outside of his experience and his knowledge and his training. So, you know, and yet that's the philosophy we had. If you were the special agent in charge of a particular geographic area in the FBI, then you were in charge of doing these things, whether we had prepared you and trained you to do it or not.
Right.
And the smart ones know to listen to people, you know, like me, who have spent most of their careers focused on a particular specialty, but some have to kind of puff their chest out and say, I'm in charge and I'm going to show you I'm in charge because I'm going to make decisions. And even though you have recommended the opposite, I'm going to show you who's the boss. I mean, that's bureaucracy. It happens not just in the government. It happens in the private sector as well. And, you know, these are things that you have to watch out for, and it's tough.
This has been awesome. Do you still have anything to do with the FBI? Do you still go back and help them with the negotiating stuff?
Not much. I mean, I'll occasionally get a call from my old unit that'll ask my thoughts on something. And, you know, I'm always available to them, but they don't reach out very often. And that's fine. I don't expect them to. I've been retired some years now. So it's basically down to Gary Who. That's okay. Right. What did you do again? You know, and right. Your name sounds vaguely familiar, but that's just life. You know, that's the way it goes, and that's fine. You know, and I wrote a lot of articles, and I think had a big contribution to the FBI's curriculum. So the things that I believed in and taught are still taught today. So I feel like that's a good legacy that I'm proud of.
Yeah, well, you should be. Congratulations. Thank you for your 30 years of service in the FBI. Seriously, this has been awesome. I enjoy it. I could do this all day listening to your stories. So I really appreciate it.
I can't. I'd fall asleep if you did it all day. No. I very much enjoyed speaking with you, and thanks for having me on your show. I hope your listeners will enjoy, you know, what we've talked about today.
Yes, I think they will. I think they will. And I very much did. And we'll have to do this again.
I'm happy to do it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gary. We'll see you next time.